Transitioning from CEO to chair. The role of an executive differs from that of a non-executive on a board. The hands-on qualities that are appreciated in an executive setting might be experienced as interference by management if applied in a board role. Some CEOs make a move to chair without missing a beat. They understand how to leverage their executive experience and won't interfere with the decisions unless the long-term interests of the business and its stakeholders are threatened. Others, it is fair to say, aren't quite so enlightened and fuel perceptions that put up barriers for those that wish to make the transition. Welcome to the Better Boards podcast series. In this episode, I'm thrilled to talk with Steve Holliday. Steve has been Chief Executive Officer of the FTSE 100 organization National Grid for almost 10 years and has successfully transitioned to Chair and Non-Executive Director. I'm Dr. Sabine Demkowski, Founder and Managing Partner of Better Boards. We make the boards of the most ambitious organizations more effective. Our mission at Better Boards is to contribute to creating better boards. We do this by providing clients with an evidence-based approach for board evaluations and board development programs. To fulfill our mission, we give a voice to all who care about creating better boards. Steve, thank you so much for making time for us in your very, very busy calendar. And thank you for contributing to the Better Boards podcast series.
It's my pleasure, Sabine.
You were the CEO of National Grid, and people in the UK and well abroad know you. When you made the transition, it would have been easy for you to take another CEO role. When I listened to you in our preparation for this podcast, it sounded like that you have chosen rather the harder route.
Well, we might come on to it. Is it harder or not? But it was a clear choice for me. I mean, I had the joy of being the CEO of National Grid for almost 10 years. I absolutely loved that job. I love the company, the organization, its people, everything it did. So it was a great joy. But it was clear that it was time for someone else to come in and run that organization. So my retirement was planned for over a two-year period. So it wasn't sort of a knee-jerk decision at all. And I was clear, actually, as well, as I said, it's just such an amazing job that I wanted to do something different. If I did take on another CEO job, the chance of it being as fulfilling and as joyous as National Grid was going to be unlikely. And you'd feel really miserable going into thinking, God, you know, I'd had such a great job. Why am I doing this now? So for me, there was never an option. It was always going to be, let's do something fundamentally very different. That was quite an easy decision. How you then get from A to B, of course, is where the hardship comes in. It's not necessarily as easy as I might have thought.
And what were the challenges you encountered?
I mean, the most surprising thing, you know, I left National Grid in the middle of 2016. So it's, you know, 5 years ago now. I remember having a number of conversations with search firms and a kind of a constant theme, but a pretty recurrent theme of, oh, you've been a CEO and an active CEO, you know, someone who's known to sort of be quite hands-on in a sense. So people are going to be very wary of the fact that you're going to be too involved in the business and want to interfere in the business. And I remember sitting back in these conversations being quite shocked. And being shocked on the basis of, first of all, thinking that almost being intellectually insulted about, do you really think I've not thought about this? It hasn't occurred to me, that situation. And, you know, I wouldn't be thinking about doing this unless I'd emotionally got myself and prepared myself for the fact that this is a different role. So that was the first point. And I might have said that on one or two occasions, but by and large, that's a thought I kept to myself. What I did say, though, I think on almost every occasion, is just reflect on my own experiences, is that if you've been a CEO, you're acutely aware of the dividing line between the CEO and the chair, you know, how to build that relationship, how to make it work, and the fact that you've got to be crystal clear between the two of you about, you know, who is doing what at what times, etc. You know, where is the split of responsibilities here? And in fact, I would even suggest that there isn't anybody better to be acutely aware of that than someone who has been a CEO, because you've been the other side of this relationship. And I had the joy of working with a number of chairmen, and we were always clear about the difference in the roles, et cetera, and how the focus of each of us should move around from time to time. And it may well be that someone who'd never been a CEO actually always aspired to be a CEO would be more likely to want to get their fingers in and control things to a certain extent. So it's a really strange conversation. And it almost concluded, it never was said, that if you went away on holiday for 2 years, then came back, people will have assumed, oh, okay, you know, you sort of decompressed now. You're now ready for a different pace of life. I just found all those conversations really slightly strange.
And how difficult was it in practice to take your hands off, not rolling your sleeves up? Because you must have seen situations where you thought, gosh, I know exactly how to do this. I have been there. If I would do it now, it would be quicker.
Yeah, but that is the same answer to an extent. I mean, it was really clear. I didn't want to be a CEO anymore. And therefore, I'm not here 5 days a week, 10 hours a day. I'm not running the thing at all. And very sensitive to that. So it was just, I mean, to me, that wasn't that difficult, frankly. That was a conscious decision. It wasn't as if I woke up on a Monday morning and all of a sudden started a new role on a Tuesday. This had been planned for several years that there was going to be a transition here. So I, you know, very, very well prepared for that. But you don't sit alongside somebody who's in the driver's seat and let them hit the thing in front of you. So, you know, there are opportunities to advise and help. But there are times and places in which you can do that. So I've been involved in several situations in the past 5 years where if you built a successful relationship with the CEO, then there's an opportunity for on a one-on-one basis to just chat through a few things, et cetera, without grabbing hold of the steering wheel, just to use that metaphor for a second at all, just to help. And if you built the right sort of relationship, which I enjoyed with my chairman, and the CEO is the right person, then that works really, really well. So I've just not felt that pressure at all, in a sense. I think if you'd gone into the wrong organization and didn't feel that you could input at all, however the way, then you might create that problem. But that's all about choosing the right place to go in the first time.
So what were your criteria for assessing if a role on a board is really right for you?
Well, you know, this is a funny story in a sense, and slightly embarrassing as well, because you know, I'm an engineer, so I think in a structured way. I plan things, and as I was saying, you know, for a couple of years I was planning I was retiring, so you know, I created a matrix of criteria of things that you know I ought to consider, I'd be interested in, and businesses that I wouldn't be interested in, and everything else, and all this plethora of data, and actually, it's summarized down to just three tests that I then did write down, and really simple. And test number one, you know, is this a business that I was going to be really interested in? Was I interested in what it was this business did? Mm-hmm. Would I be proud to be associated with it? Which reflects back to the joy I had in my executive life. You know, National Grid is a marvelous company sitting in the middle of the energy transition with a real purpose in society and caring deeply about its impact on society. So, you know, that those attributes are really important to me. Secondly, I also had the joy in my life of working with some super people that I just thoroughly enjoy spending my time with. So I'm not now going to spend my time in semi-retirement with people I don't want to spend my time with. So again, you know, the personal aspects of the people who you're going to be interacting with on a frequent basis, really important to me. And the third area was, you know, just assuming that you there's something here and there's a spec and you know, here's the job. Just think that you've got something personally that you might be able to bring to the party that just might be a slight unique USP. If you have, that's just, again, I'm probably going to make it more enjoyable for you and more successful. So I wrote these three things down, and then I entered into a number of roles early on, which I wasn't enjoying for various reasons. And then I looked at my test and thought, you know, you fool. You went all this process and wrote these things down. And in one case, it only ticks one of the three boxes. It's not at all surprising that you're not particularly enjoying it. And so I've been a bit more disciplined since, and surprise, surprise, you know, I thoroughly enjoy the things that I'm involved in today.
I mean, I spoke with a lot of people who are then so keen to get this first chair role that they throw them out of the window. Would you advise other CEOs who think about making the transition to follow your three criteria?
Well, they're my three criteria, so they're not necessarily to everyone's taste. I think the first one, you ought to be in a business that you're proud to be involved with and you got a bit of a passion for. It's going to come over to other people as the chair, I think, if that isn't the case. So I think that must be one that ought to apply to a lot of people. Whether everyone cares as much about the personal relationships as I do, that's probably a more personal attribute. But again, you didn't ought to be working with people who you don't get some enjoyment out of spending your time with. And my third test, though, is probably more specific in a sense. There are, you know, you can go in and do a really good job necessarily by doing the job itself. You don't necessarily have to have anything that you're personally bringing in. So I think that's a bit more of a personal one, which shouldn't be confused with wanting to run the company again either. It's just, you know, it's just something in here that I think is, I can be particularly helpful here. You know, I would advise anyone, you know, to just think it through before you jump in, just to write down, you know, what are the most important criteria for you as an individual.
And based on your experience, is there anything that nomination committees could and should do differently when they think about selecting candidates for the chair role?
Well, it's a bit of a mystical process, isn't it, to an extent? These are private conversations, and in my experience in various organisations, handled very differently in different organisations as well. I've been in nominations committee as a CEO, not a member clearly, but you know, in those conversations around chair succession and other successions. I've been in as a independent director, a member of the nominations committee in a couple of organisations. You know, I've seen quite different processes actually, and quite different processes in terms of the utilisation of the search firms as well. So you know, just whether the search firms are really deeply involved in that process and designing that process, working in partnership, or whether they're almost a, you know, a contractor on one side who, you know, will get you to do certain bits of work, but actually you're excluded from a lot of the conversation. So, you know, there's huge variability without any question. And everything else in life, we test KPIs, how successful it is. So one of the questions I might suggest is, you know, what are the success criteria of nominations committee? Filling a box, getting someone into a role who passes a smell test and is okay, feels occasionally as if that's probably the criteria, because it's quite hard to get any metric around, you know, did we manage to recruit someone into a role here who absolutely has made a difference in this organization? That's quite hard to measure. So I think that, you know, one of the things that you would worry about, some of my observations, is occasionally safety first. I was involved in a chair appointment process where it just felt to me that actually we were looking for a safe pair of hands as opposed necessarily to the best person to do this job.
If there is one thing that you would like to tell nomination committees, what would it be?
It goes back to criteria again to a certain extent. You know, anyone will produce you the standard boilerplate chairman specification. There's a question around, this is a chairman in 2021. So would that spec be the same spec 5 years ago? Yeah, all the boilerplate stuff probably would. Might have moved a bit around it in terms of risk focus and things these days, but fundamentally it's there. Given our business right now, given the challenges we've got right now as a business, given the macro environment right now, and given the executive team we've got right now and the rest of the board, what are the specific things that we're looking for in the next chair of this organization? And I think a conversation around that, and again, not trying to create a long list here, you know, it's two or three things, is a valuable conversation to have, particularly when you then go through the process and end up with maybe a final three set of candidates, to go right back to the beginning and go, so back to me having written down my list and then ignoring it. Let's go back to those things we thought about. Because by clear, they've got down to three. They can all now do the job. Is there one of these candidates that goes back to those special little things that are for this business in this macro environment with this executive team are going to be the best choice for us to make? And I kind of felt in some things that I've been involved in as part of a selection process that we just didn't do that as well as we might have done.
When we previously spoke, Steve, you mentioned that there is a tendency to really play it safe.
That's always a risk, I think. I mean, I do recall a process that was driven by the search firm as much as anything else in presenting in the early days of the conversation, as often happens, let me give you some ideas of the sort of people. And they put people into three lists. They put a list of very experienced chairmen. They put a list of recently retiring executives, CFOs and CEOs and others. And then a third list of people who were coming out of government, senior civil servants or heads of the top four financial organizations or big consultancies, et cetera, which although the lists were headed up in that way, you could easily have retitled those lists very low risk, medium risk and high risk. And it wasn't surprising that that conversation said, well, let's just put list 2 and 3 to one side for a second. Show me everyone on this list one, because that's going to be an easy place for us to go. So that's, you know, that you've got to be careful in that sense that you're missing something in list two or list three that might actually, go back to my point, be the right person for this job. It can be very easy to get the process starts to almost predict the answer in a very early phase, and unless you're careful about that.
Let's switch slightly. When I listen to institutional investors, they tell me that there are only a handful of great shares in the UK, and the rest is classified as mediocre and rubbish. What is it that makes a good share?
I'd be really interested in asking them the question. What are the criteria that you're using to make that point, whether the point is right or wrong? But you know, what are your criteria? I don't know the answer to that question. Do you?
I wish.
Because that, you know, that ought to go flow back into the process that we've just been talking about,
yeah,
and the specification, the criteria, etc. So for me, the great chairs that I've worked with were passionate about the business. You know, they really cared about what the business was doing. And therefore, in all of their interfaces with employees in the organization, around the board table, when they are meeting investors, when they're meeting stakeholders and customers, etc., you can't hide that stuff. You know, if you care about something, I think it comes out. So that, you know, that's really important. Building a successful relationship with the CEO.
Mm.
I mean, everyone says that, don't they? It's statement of the obvious. But, you know, it takes work. You've got to sit.
Yeah.
It takes work to go back to, as I said, making sure you're clear about the roles, keep that in front of you on an annual basis, refreshing. Are we still actually complementing each other? Where can we divide and conquer? Where do we collaborate? And again, that comes across. I think it's always surprising the rest of the organization can see whether the chair and the CEO get on. And it's important to, you know, to be perceived to get on. That doesn't mean agreeing all the time. Of course, a bit of stress in the relationship, but fundamentally are working together. And then the board, you know, the working to make sure that board works as it, like any team works as a team. And it's always been slightly extraordinary to me, the amount of money and effort that goes into selecting board members. It's always been the case. I mean, the processes that we put people through to become independent directors, number of interviews, and they come onto the board, and then there you go, off you go. We'll give you an induction program in the business, and everything's going to be swimming. You know, it's almost a sporting analogy. You've hired all these Galacticos on the pitch, but it doesn't automatically mean that they're all going to perform fantastically together when they're together. And you know, a really good chairman, in my view, is just put a little bit of extra effort around the fringes, however they want to do it in terms of interventions, to try and make sure that the collective really does work. And that's what differentiates, I think, that the chairman that makes a huge difference.
I mean, I had the honor of working with some chairs that are classified as great chairs. And what I notice is they make it look so easy. I mean, when you observe it, it doesn't almost look like work. But they know exactly what to do. It's just amazing. But it looks from the outside really easy and effortless.
Well, that's like a sporting analogy almost, isn't it? I mean, the great players make things look, whatever sport it is, look really easy. But when it's not, it's hours and hours and hours and hours of training.
Yeah.
But you're right. And I certainly learnt from the chairs that I've worked with and try and practice now. You know, when do you draw a line under conversations? You know, when do you intervene? When do you try and move things on? How do you make sure that you make decisions there and say, like, you know, we can't agree, so let's just move on. Well, that's not helpful. But, you know, how, in a sense, do you make sure you get there but don't let things go on? I mean, there's some really classy ways of doing that. And I've watched a few chairs do that in, as you say, sort of what appears just to be such an elegant and seamless way. Mm. That the rest of the board doesn't feel as if they're being cajoled either, in a sense. And, you know, you're also this... the great skill set of just bringing people into the conversation, which goes back to my team around a board. You know, there are people who are noisy and there are people who are quiet. It's just a fact of life. And we kind of observe that even more, I think, on Zoom board meetings and Teams board meetings, etc. Just making sure you don't end up with a couple of people who aren't getting a point across. And, you know, really good chairs just are watching that like a hawk, I think.
Steve, thank you so, so much. Coming to the end of it, what are the three things our listeners shall take away from this podcast?
I think if you're aspiring to be a chair, then I would advise you just to think carefully about what it is that you really want out of that, because that will make you more successful without any question. I think that I would say to nominations committee almost the flip side of that, as I said, you know, these, think about this business, this team, this macro environment, you know, is there anything in particular that we need from our next chair, given that we don't hire chairs for 2 year stints, and we're bringing people in who are going to be doing 6+ years. It's a big decision. And so it's often going to see through a CEO succession as well, potentially. So I just really think putting in all the hard yards on the specificity of that individual is definitely worth it. And my third bit, I would just encourage all chairs actually to do all the things that are good practice these days about a board review and a process review and all those good stuff, but really, really put as much effort and time into making sure, having assembled the best team, that team is genuinely working as a team in the best interest of the organization and the executive team.
Fantastic. It was a great honor to have you, Steve. Thank you so, so much for contributing to the Better Bots podcast series.
My pleasure, Sabine. You take care of yourself.
How can we help you and your board? We at Better Bots are always delighted to hear from you. You can best reach us at info@better-bots.com. Thank you for listening.